I'm Corinne Miller. I'm the Director of Visual Arts for Cultural Development Corporation, and I manage the Flashpoint Gallery and our other various visual arts activities. I think this is actually a really nice opportunity to bring the visual arts community to Source, which is our other facility. We also have a facility downtown, which is Flashpoint, which some of you probably know, but we've owned and operated Source since 2006. So the panel today is presented in partnership between Flashpoint Gallery and the Emerge Art Fair. I want to begin by thanking the Pink Line Project and Philippa Hughes for helping to promote the event and helping us get the word out. I'd also like to thank Marvin and Sheldon Scott, who will be hosting a little after party for us. It was originally, I think, going to be on their roof deck, but you might have noticed it's a little rainy out today. So I think they're going to open up at 5 for us, and they're going to have $5 Stellas. I, of course, want to thank Lee Connor and Jamie Smith for having the foresight and vision to do this Emerge series of panel discussions. So Jamie Smith, who's a partner at Connor Contemporary Art, approached me, I think, was it last summer?
Yes.
It was a while ago, about doing a panel discussion together. And we began talking about how arts organizations have begun pushing exhibition practices out of the white box and into the public sphere and alternative spaces. And in some ways, this is something that's been going on a long time, but I think there's been a resurgence and a renewed interest in this practice. So we talked about how this manifests itself in a variety of ways, and we'll be digging hopefully deeper into that as we talk today. So it's anything from permanent and temporary public art projects, guerrilla art projects, alternative exhibition spaces, and even to things like art fairs, which Jamie's going to talk to us a little bit about the Emerge Art Fair and how that's rethinking and re-envisioning the traditional art fair model. And then lastly, I'll just say that discussions like this are particularly interesting to me because I think they can simultaneously operate as very philosophical and very practical discussions, which hopefully we'll have a little bit of both here today. So I'm going to play the role of moderator slash taskmaster, and luckily there's actually a clock here that I can watch. So I'm going to try and keep us on schedule and keep this to about an hour, and then hopefully we can continue the conversation afterwards at Marvin later. So I'd like to dive in and have each of the panelists do a quick two-minute introduction of who they are and where they're coming from. And then we'll dive into some questions and some discussion, and then we'll save about 10 minutes at the end for some Q&A and some back and forth. So, Calder, do you want to get us started?
Sure.
Okay.
First of all, thank you guys for hosting this, Flashpoint and Emerge. It's a wonderful opportunity. And thank you all for coming out in the rain to see us. I'm Calder Brannick, and I am the director of Camper Contemporary, which is a mobile art gallery. I started, I guess, a year and a half ago now. I had been to some art fairs. I used to work for a gallery, the Fraser Gallery out in Bethesda, who is here. And I was really excited about the way galleries change the way you see art, and also excited about the art fair system, and had been down to Miami a few years ago and decided, you know, I really want to get down here next year and show some work. I think that'd be a lot of fun, but didn't have a gallery representing me. I was in grad school, and there wasn't really a chance of me, you know, having a gallery represent me. So I said, you know what? I'm just going to build my own gallery. Wouldn't it be neat to build a gallery on wheels that I could take with me? All these galleries are shipping their work down and setting it up in these booths. And I said, why not just skip that and build the gallery on wheels? And it started kind of as a joke, but then became an interesting idea to bring this formal gallery setting along to these alternate locations and show work from artists, you know, places where there are a lot of artists like D.C. and Baltimore, but especially in Baltimore, there aren't as many collectors, and take them to where the collectors are. And so that, coupled with the adventure residency program I started, where I take artists on trips and then have them respond to those trips with work, has been kind of my art practice for the last year and a half.
Hello, I'm Jamie McClellan. I'm the director and founder of Civilian Art Projects here in D.C. And prior to that, I co-founded Transformer with Victoria Reese. And prior to that, I was at D.C. Art Center. That was my first job in the arts. Before that, I was a fine art photographer showing my work in kind of any space, collaborating with a lot of friends. And I feel really fortunate to be doing what I'm doing. And I look at Civilian definitely as definitely a DIY space. It's it's a commercial gallery by label, but it's very much kind of a democratic art space in my mind. We do exist through art sales, and thankfully we've been able to exist through a recession with art sales. But I also, you know, do a bunch of other things. Like I'm an independent curator, and I started teaching recently at St. Mary's and the Corcoran College. That's it? Okay, thanks.
I'm Jamie Smith. Corinne already introduced me. I am a co-director of Connor Contemporary Art, where my partner Lee Connor and I have exhibited emerging and mid-career artists for 12 years now. About 10 years ago, I initiated the Academy Annual Graduate Exhibition. Out of that, our GoGo Art projects stemmed. Lee's idea was to have an intermediate sort of program where artists can negotiate between coming out of grad school or just starting their practice and entering into professional life. Last year, for the 10th anniversary of Academy, we started a series of panel discussions, which really arose from my interaction over 10 years with emerging artists and students and hearing their questions and getting a gauge of their needs. And definitely one of those needs is more exhibition opportunities, which is the topic of today's talk.
Hi, everybody. My name is Don Russell, and I'm the executive director of Provisions Library. And Provisions is an arts and social change research center here in D.C. We've been operating for about 10 years. But I myself have been active in the D.C. art scene since about 1982 or so, actually maybe even before that. But I worked at the Washington Project for the Arts when they moved down to 7th Street. I was director of programs there. And at that point in time, WPA was doing a lot of public sculpture, temporary public sculpture. So there is maybe an almost invisible or forgotten history of public art in D.C. Most notably, there was a project done with Nancy Rubin, who did this piece at the base of the Whitehurst Freeway. There are all those interchanges, and there's a little hill. And on top of this hill, she constructed a cyclone of trash. So it's really a tornado, which is appropriate for this weather we're having, made out of used appliances. So she would go to Goodwill and get, you know, hundreds and hundreds of used appliances, and was all set up there. And it was a very radical sort of act at the time. And it actually, you know, started a period of time where WPA could do projects, and there were developers and people that were interested in kind of shaking up the community at the time. So there's that. More recently, Provisions is very interested in the act of moving art into public space, taking it out of even the art world context altogether. This is an exhibition catalog. You're welcome to take copies of this. It's called Close Encounters 2, Acts of Social Imagination. And it sort of compared the strategies of artists doing socially engaged work in a gallery setting, and then such an artist would be paired with an artist that does public work in public space. So it's just an overview. It's a good introduction, I think. Also, with Provisions, we've sponsored Street Scenes, which was Nora Halpern and Velmud Lanstra. And we did several really interesting projects with them. One was the Jenny Holzer projection project from the roof of the Kennedy Center onto Roosevelt Island. And what was projected were excerpts from speeches by President Kennedy and Teddy Roosevelt. And they mixed them together without attribution. So there was this very interesting commentary about, you know, arts and freedom and the environment and ecology. And we also work with Floating Lab Collective, doing a number of sort of community-based art projects. We can talk about that later.
Yeah. My name is Jose Ruiz. I currently live in New York, but I do come to D.C. every couple weeks, primarily because I recently started a project called Furthermore, which is sort of a multifaceted arts initiative that was launched this past fall. And there's multiple layers. It's sort of a long-term project for me that will probably take shape over the next 5 years, I think. Prior to that, I did live in D.C. probably from between 1997 and 2004, and I was fairly active in, I guess, the D.C. art scene at the time, organizing shows and participating in shows. I'm primarily an artist, but also as of recent, I've been doing a lot of curatorial work. So in the past couple of years, I've done shows for the Queens Museum. I'm working on a show for the Bronx Museum right now, as well as co-curating the Incheon Biennial, which is in South Korea, this October. For about 4 years, between 2006 and 2010, I ran the gallery program, and I was a curator at the Bronx River Arts Center, which is a community-based art center in the Bronx, in a particularly interesting area just because it's I guess, one of the most socially in need areas of the Bronx. And, you know, looking at it nationally, it's a pretty, you know, across the board, there's a lot of issues there. So it was interesting to work there, primarily just because it was a real opportunity to engage with the community, and there was a lot of hardships that we had to sort of try to assess and try to build programming around those difficulties. So I think that's primarily what I've been up to the past couple of years. Yeah. So.
Thanks, everyone. So I wanted to start by talking a little bit sort of about the historical context that all of this is emerging from. And I was doing a little bit of research about the NEA's workshop program that was established in 72, and it funded a lot of early artist spaces. And they described the program as in terms of the importance of artist self-determination and of the importance of non-commercial, bare-walled, ripped-out alternative spaces run by artists for artists. So I thought maybe Don and Jamie could provide a little, and everyone else, a little bit of sort of historical context, Don, about your experience with the WPA, and Jamie as our sort of resident art historian on the panel.
So before I even came to Washington, I worked in an alternative space in Rochester, New York, called the Visual Studies Workshop. And actually, my first job there was to drive a mobile bookstore of alternative press literature all over the sort of northeastern part of the United States. And, you know, it was a victim, ultimately, of that energy crisis, because it was a very large van. But basically, we took alternative artist books and materials such as that around to college campuses and museums all over the place, and actually coming to Washington was one of the best stops for us. So that's, you know, part of why I'm here now. But I also got involved up there in artist books, which themselves, I believe, are a very potent alternative space for ideas. And ultimately, I started a bookstore for artist books at WPA, which lasted for about 15 years. But you mentioned the artist space movement, which really was, I think, an outgrowth of the 60s. Alternative institutions immediately after the Vietnam War. Nixon was putting a lot of money into the arts for whatever reason. He actually legislated the largest increase in the NEA's budget. And a lot of this was going into alternative ideas, perhaps to absorb the energies of the anti-war movement. So I'll let you carry on from there.
Thank you.
Pick that up later.
Don, earlier you mentioned street scenes, and I'll just give an example of how one of our artists sort of integrated our gallery into the street and community when we were at DuPont Circle by participating in street scenes. Brandon Morris did a sound project which was housed inside of a porta potty outside of the gallery on Connecticut Avenue.
Non-functioning
and non-used porta potty. This was one way to get art out into the street in sort of a surprising format that let people.
Whatever it takes.
Yes, whatever it takes, and that's what we have to do sometimes. Whatever it takes, but that's the great thing about emerging art is that artists have new ideas and they don't conform. They're looking at things, you know, with fresh eyes. So that's one way to to get out of the gallery, because as a gallerist, Lee and I can tell you that you can't sit in your gallery and wait for the world to come to you. And when you get excited about the work that your artists are doing, you want to help them connect with their audiences however you can. Another example is Mary Coble, who did a performance at the U Street Cardozo metro station, where she stood outside on a hot summer day and let people write the most derogatory language in Sharpie marker all over her, just as a way to bring people together and reflect on some of the hurtful things that people can say to each other sometimes and what kind of impact that has. She was later invited to perform at ARCO, so she did another version of that performance called Marker Madrid, where very foul expressions were written all over her in Spanish and other languages. They're one of the people who witnessed that performance in Madrid was Helen Allen, who's the founder and former director of the Pulse Art Fair, who's now partnering with me and Lee to organize the Emerge Art Fair here in Washington, D.C. And Helen was very inspired by Mary's performance in Madrid, she and Lee and I talked about how we could enhance direct participation by artists in art fairs, because art fairs are a very particular commercial format. It's not always easy to do that. But Helen was very courageous and worked with us, and of course Mary is a courageous artist. So Mary compiled all of the names that had been written on her in D.C., New York, and Madrid, and then she did a performance called Blood Script, where she had the words inklessly tattooed on her body over the course of 2 days in front of a live audience at the Pulse New York Art Fair. So this is one way that we can bring artists into contact with their audiences. And historically speaking, this goes back to the origins of art fairs, which started in Northern Europe during the Renaissance period. And at that time, artists themselves rented the stalls, and it was an extension of their atelier. So it's sort of going back to the roots of art fairs themselves.
Great. Thanks, Jamie. Thanks, Don. So the next thing that I want to talk a little bit about is something that I'm very interested in is how artists have driven these changes versus institutions, and how artists' sort of modes and methods of production sort of force institutions to rethink the way that they exhibit art. And I think even in thinking about the show that you have up right now, Jamie, of Patrick McDonough's work, who's here, and how maybe that's a project that's not conducive to your gallery proper, but you've figured out a way to show an artist like that. And I think Calder, with your projects, it's a similar sort of instance where you've created a form that allows you to do what you want to do. I don't know if you guys want to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I have kind of inherited a great old building on 7th Street, part of the Rupert family's buildings, and moved in there about a year ago. And we're on the second and third floor, and furthermore is on the third floor of the building and has the print shop part of furthermore up there. And we also rent a back office to a group of architects. And so I'm big on making use of all the spaces in the building. And we have this great foyer space that I always saw as a project space, and it took a while to kind of get it going. But I started to talk to Patrick about doing a show in that space. I wanted to do non-object-based work, things that were more sound-based or site-specific, and his work lent to that perfectly. I encourage you all to come see it. It's up until the end of May. But in terms of using anything that's available to you, I mean, there's a huge tradition of that in the East and, you know, in the United States, 70s performance art. Any place you can imagine, artists have interacted and done interventions and
kind of my background. I did a lot of work with artists from the former Yugoslavia, and I was really influenced by The Body in the East, which was a book and an exhibition all about performance art, art of the body. So it doesn't look like it from the surface, but I think civilian is a very decided model of how to best support artists in this landscape, particularly, even though I've taken into account all of the different models that there are, especially, you know, depending on the economy that you're in. And the amount of freedom that I wanted for an art space was afforded by directly selling work, but that's not all that I want to do or want the gallery to do. But it's driven almost exclusively by the artist's voice and vision. So I was lucky enough to work with someone like Patrick, and I'm going to be working with Billy Friebel and an artist, Ann Tague from New Orleans, and other artists to really utilize every inch of the space and the outside of the space and spaces that aren't ours, like the bar next door, and really kind of open up an opportunity for everyone to engage in what the gallery does. And that takes a while as a new gallery to be able to do that, because you have to be able to pay the bills and you have to be able to help the artist make a living. So we're right at that point. We're about 4 years old. We're right at that. And that's exciting, because I was doing that for a long time before starting Civilian, so I'm really happy to be doing that now.
Well, and with the mobile art gallery, I think one of the advantages of that is I don't have to pay rent. Mm-hmm. It's parked in my parents' backyard right now, and so I am paying rent in a way. But, you know, it gives me an opportunity to show up in locations where you might not normally encounter art, and find this well-polished gallery with interesting ideas inside. And I think that's the wonderful thing about art, is I love it because I can have these conversations with people, and I can have a dialogue in places where dialogue might not normally exist. And so the gallery is an excellent opportunity to do that. This year I had the good fortune of showing through Connor at Pulse, and so I won the Pulse Prize, and so I was able to show in the art fair itself. But last year, I just got a group of artists. Most of them were from MICA and went to grad school with me, and we just showed up. And there was such a great energy. People were, you know, going from fair to fair to fair and seeing the booths, and everything was blurring together. And we showed up with this weird gallery that was parked at meters. You know, we were feeding it on the street. And I mean, people got excited again, because they're like, well, it's sort of like graffiti. It's in unexpected places. And so it started a fun dialogue with people both that were kind of pooped from going from place to place to place to seeing the same thing, but also people who weren't necessarily into the art. I think some of the best were people who weren't going to the art fairs, who kind of go by all this stuff all the time. And another thing we did is I convinced everyone we should wear blue jumpsuits, these travel suits, which was a terrible idea in Miami because it's ridiculously hot. But when they were going through the art fairs or walking down the street, you know, you'd see two people in the blue jumpsuits, and then two more, and then two more, and so it got people asking questions, you know, what are you guys, you know, are you maintenance, are you crazy people, why are you wearing these suits? And so then we were able to transition and to talk about our own practice and sort of develop a dialogue with people who never would have approached us before that. And so I think the gallery and the jumpsuits and these things give us a wonderful opportunity to reach out to people who might not necessarily come into a gallery or come into a museum, because there's that kind of stigma that you should have a certain level of education or you should, you know, or it's going to be boring. I mean, so many people are like, oh, I don't want to go to a museum, but they're really exciting once you get inside. And so this is a way to kind of bridge that gap, to bring people into the ideas, and then maybe from there it opens a door so that you can further into the art world, I guess.
Thanks. Calder also lobbied me to get the panelists to wear matching outfits, as an aside. That was vetoed. Jose, I was wondering if you could maybe follow up on that with your work, with Furthermore, and also as an artist, and where you fit in and where.
Follow up on.
Just what Calder and Jamie have talked about, and also this idea of just like the fluidity in what you're doing. You're working in both New York and D.C. You work as both a curator and an artist. You've worked in the public sphere.
Okay. Well, I guess an inspiration for me is to really work with artists directly or as close as I can. So a lot of the projects I set up pretty much have that component built in from the beginning. Obviously, there's times where I may have to do it a little bit differently because it's a different type of project, but the main thing that drives me is actually working with artists. You know, so even the idea of Furthermore, is actually definitely inspired by even the Bauhaus movement. I think if there's something that I could bring to the table would be to try to, over obviously a lifetime's worth of work, is to try to elevate the role of the artist in society, which is obviously it's a big job to do, and obviously everyone's trying to do that together. But I think before even you get to that point, you have to, within the art world in general, you have to sort of level all the hierarchies. So I think that's one of the things that's shaped furthermore. I mean, I think if you look at the Bauhaus movement, designers, typesetters, academics, artists, dancers, we're all sort of operating under the same arena or working together collaboratively. So I look at that and just sort of wonder, how can that be done, obviously in a better way, but also in maybe in a long-lasting way in the 21st century. So I think so that's primarily my interest in, design, architecture, politics. I would say in the past couple of years, I look at that stuff more than art. I look at art a lot based on the projects I'm doing, but, really inspired more just by the real world, or things are happening outside of the art world, and those influence me in what I do, but I think all the projects that are successful are ones where the people are going out to the streets, or trying to open the doors as wide as they can. A good example is, just by chance, I think last Thanksgiving I saw that CNN Heroes, I don't know if anyone's seen that, it's like this sort of tear jerk sort of event where they give someone an award for doing good community work, but it's actually a pretty serious thing. In that case, using that as an example, all those projects were initiated by someone that the only way to do it was to go to where the people were, where there was a mobile health clinic, going into parts of Florida, or a guy, sort of a traveling soup kitchen, or in Queens, that's how I found out about it. Or in Asia, almost like schools, where schools don't exist, people are really going there. So I think that's and that is rooted back, I think, to activism, and rooted back to some sort of political stance and how you think you can participate.
Yeah, and I think that touches on another thing that I wanted to talk about, which is sort of the breakdown of hierarchies between institutions and artists with the audiences. And, something that Don actually said to me, I think it was years ago, was about how, you can probably say it more articulately than I can, but about how bringing art into the public sphere is so great because it sort of intertwines and meshes art with life in a way that doesn't happen in exhibition spaces.
Well, Jose was talking about the Bauhaus and sort of the interdisciplinary nature of things. And that's really the beginning, sort of in the art world, when the disciplines start breaking down and commingling is always a very interesting thing. But for me and the work that I've done with Provisions is that we started out very firmly with one foot in the social change world and one foot very firmly in the art world. And I feel as though they're kind of irreconcilable in many ways. But that does not mean that artists, individual artists, can't move into the middle of all that. And I call it an unstable middle, where many different random things can happen. Important leverage points can be established. And so that's sort of been our goal, is to look at, what's the quality of the engagement? Is this a creative activism that's virtually art? Or is it, very socially relevant art that's, virtually activism. So it's that tension that really drives our work.
Go ahead.
I would just add, too, you mentioned something about, the actual physical space. And, I would just put a footnote that the physical gallery space is still very much needed, even as there's a more of a trend or prominence to go outside. The gallery can still, or the gallery museum, it can still function as a resource center, or a community space, or even a place where, they dispatch from or come back to.
Jamie, do you want to talk a little bit more about the art fair and just sort of how artists participate in that model?
Yeah,
as well.
I like the expression quality of engagement that Don used. And I think that we want to promote, we want to make a place and a time to let an experience unfold between emerging artists and collectors, curators, and other audiences. It's wonderful to walk through a major art fair anywhere in the world. It's very exciting and interesting and fascinating. But it's not always the most welcoming atmosphere for a young artist or an artist whose practice is relatively new. Many artists have told me that they don't necessarily feel that's the place for them. So we're trying to create a new type of art fair experience where people are not on their iPhones and they're out of the VIP lounges and they're into conversations with artists. So one of the ways that we're promoting that kind of interaction is to have an artist exhibition platform for unrepresented artists, because what you usually see at art fairs are galleries who have hired booths and showing their stable of artists, which we will have too, a component of the traditional art fair based on the Gramercy Park hotel model that originated in the early 1990s. So we will have gallerists who are leaders in promoting emerging art around the world, showing their programs in the hotel rooms, but throughout the common spaces of the hotel, in the lobby, the lounge, the pool area, and everywhere else we can think of, even the garage is not off limits. We're giving free exhibition space to vetted artist proposals. So we have an open call out for artist applications right now. And we have a vetting committee of world-renowned art professionals and collectors, including Mira Rubel, Matthew Higgs, Biko Vashalari, and Kristen Heilman. So they will be reviewing the proposals carefully and selecting as many projects as we can fit into the space.
I had one other opportunity that I don't want to forget to mention that's coming up, hasn't been announced yet. I serve on the Public Art Committee for the DC Commission on the Arts and Humanities, and very shortly there will be announced a new program called 5x5, and it will be a public sculpture a temporary public art festival happening in the fall. And it will consist of five curators choosing five artists to do projects. And it really comes out of a larger strategic initiative of the commission to, you know, focus on public art, to sort of transform their public art program from one that relied on semi-permanent, you know, minimum of five-year sculpture placements to something much more borderless and along the lines of what we're talking here. So everybody, pay attention to that. It should be coming up, you know, within the next month or so, the call for curators to make proposals.
I think one of the things that's interesting about what we've been talking about is just sort of what I think of as an arts ecosystem and sort of all the parts that an arts ecosystem needs, commercial galleries, alternative spaces, temporary permanent public art projects, art fairs. And I guess maybe one of my questions is, some of them, I think, sometimes philosophically seem at odds with one another in terms of commercial galleries, art fairs. But, you know, Jamie's developing something, almost a new kind of art fair that I think can simultaneously support emerging artists and a collector base. And I don't know if all of you want to sort of talk about that and how that ecosystem is sort of getting larger and more diverse.
I'll talk about economy, I guess. This is a big thing I talk about a lot. You've heard me probably. Because I've worked in the nonprofit world, I've been a fundraiser, and I'm a gallerist who sells artwork. And, you know, in D.C., and I think this is the case in a lot of cities, smaller cities outside of New York and L.A. and maybe London and some other places, no one in the arts is really, like, getting rich. I mean, nobody, you know, your best hope, I think, as a gallerist in smaller places is to break even, and you really get into the business to support artists. and you believe in them and you want to show them and support them. And then there's this fallacy, it's a huge fallacy, that nonprofit, for-profit, I mean, it's a level playing field. We're really not talking about one better than the other. We're talking about them together as supporting artists. And the dialogue that happens, like, is, you know, artwork that's for sale, is that lesser value than artwork that's more experiential or not tied to being an object? They're all valid. You know, there are some artists who are always going to make photographs or paintings. There are some artists who are always going to be experimental in nature, and you need all of the places to support those ideas.
And I think from, you know, having worked with a lot of young artists, I mean, one thing I tell them a lot is that they, too, have to spread out their practice. You know, it's almost like having, you mentioned economy, like an investment portfolio. You don't want to put all your money into something, you know. But it's, I mean, I have some friends that they do really well with commercial galleries and art fairs, you know. But on the other hand, they're maybe having a hard time getting reviews, you know. Or, you know, so I think a lot of times it's, the artist really has to consciously actually really position their work in different ways, whether it's more academic situations, you know, university galleries, nonprofits, I guess even alternative spaces, you know. So I think there's a because there's so, there actually is a lot of opportunity there, you know, if you really want to participate. And even if you may find hardship getting into those opportunities while you're building, I guess, your career, you can still do X amount of things on your own, you know, and not necessarily wait for people to come around, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, I think the artists, too, have to step it up, too, I mean, just because.
One of the things that I've been very interested in is to try to take the artists out of the art world in a way, and to find new homes for them. Not only audience-wise, but revenue-wise. So it doesn't really exist yet too much. But imagine artists being deployed in international relations or international development work in various other ways, just bringing the artists to the table much more sort of philosophically in other spheres of society. I think that's a really valid thing to be working on.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting and really relevant to what we're talking about today. And the question I think that comes up when you talk about that is how organic is that, and what are the complications of doing that? I think it was it called Culture in Action? It was a project that was done in Chicago with artists going into communities and working with the communities to create projects. You know, and it ended up being a really sort of problematic project in a lot of ways, because people are being sort of transplanted into communities that they're not necessarily familiar with, and art is then foisted upon a community that maybe didn't ask for it or want it. And I think that's something that you have to talk about when you put art into the public sphere and when you take art out of the gallery. And I don't know if anyone wants to talk about that.
A lot of ethical questions that arise when you're sort of placing things in public space. But I also think that the world of international development, for instance, is just not in a state where they would understand the arts. It's not, a lot of this type of work is driven by metrics, results-based sort of model. And the arts are notoriously difficult to measure what the net result is. However, the way I kind of try to think about that is that arts are the metrics, or should be used as the metrics of success for development projects. You know, it's something in the hierarchy of need, you know, that where the top actually is in direct contact with the bottom. That's very technical, but if everybody knows Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs, sort of culture is always way up at the top, and I think that it's really more connected to the bottom of needs.
Another thing that I wanted to mention was when Jamie and I first started having this conversation, she sent me this article by Nato Thompson, who wrote something called Contractions of Time on Social Practice from a Temporal Perspective. And it a lot of what it talked about was how, in some ways, these practices are actually reflective of our daily life and what our society has come to in terms of how busy and overloaded we are, and that the form and the context for art is almost reflective or in response to that. And I don't know if any of you want to sort of talk about that or pick up from that.
Well, yeah, I mean, we live in a, you know, very rapid-paced, communicating world, and it is hard to find time, the space and time to create work. And we certainly see that you don't need a gallery space to, you know, have an art project. You can do it through social media or out on the street or anywhere. But I think that there's real value in challenging yourself as an artist or a writer, you know, whatever you do, whatever art form you do, if you're a curator or a writer or fine artist, is to find that space and time, even as things are really, really super hectic, because I think that's where the juice comes from. But I don't think that you have to be limited in the ways you do it and how you communicate it and what you call yourself. I think we're definitely in a phase of you can call yourself seven different things. You can have seven different professions. You can be writer, curator, artist, all of these things and more. And that is something really exciting, I think, to embrace. And the way we communicate with each other and how that's going to change even more, I think, can be defined by your individual dedication, almost your devotion to your own personal practice, I guess. And one of the things I was going to talk about, but I don't think I can get it together to talk about, is just, you know, we have this, we don't know what's going on right now. It's like a social revolution through technology, and we don't know where we're going to land. And you see a lot of things on YouTube, you see a lot of things on Facebook, and you see people like starting to scratch at and get at something. You know, we're at a place where anybody can publish a book, self-publish it online, and anybody can read it. Anybody can make music and have people follow it. I mean, we're at this place, and certain theorists are saying, you know, it's all going to be based on, do you have an audience? Do you have people who care about what you're doing? And so talk about a level playing field, you know. But I really think it takes that time, that space and time to really refine a little bit of what you're thinking and what you're doing. It requires discipline, but it doesn't require, like, boundaries, I think.
I'd like to add that, I mean, in some ways, as Jamie was saying, technology is shaping our lives and the way we interact or don't interact with each other and with artists and their art. And I know that Jamie's been involved in online projects that can bring artists together. So to the extent that virtual technology can help us make new connections in the art world, I think it's very, very useful and very fruitful. We're doing a couple of experiments with the Emerge Art Fair in our programming online. We have a couple of projects. One is called Mapping the World of Emerging Art, which is a really basic, simple impulse that we just want to identify people with like commitments and goals to emerging art, making emerging art, supporting emerging art all around the world, whoever they are, wherever they are, just to put them on the map, so to speak, give them a presence, and see, let them see who else is working around them. So that's one online project. Another one is called Swarm. It's a group participation project that's being organized by Adam Good, where artists are invited online to enter in statements about their artistic practice. And those statements will be sort of randomly scrambled and regenerated into a graphic at the art fair. So these are two ways to get people involved and also hopefully help them form new connections.
I'd actually love to open it up for questions or comments if people have any. Okay. I'm going to repeat the question just for the sake of the podcast, and you can correct me if I get it wrong. So the question is about how dance and theater can be integrated into performance pieces and conceptual pieces in existing spaces and upcoming projects.
We welcome proposals for performances for the art fair. So we hope to have live performances going on throughout the run of the fair.
Sure. Come on an adventure with me. Part of the residency program that I'm really excited about and the direction I'm moving in is I'm opening it up to people who aren't just artists. And it's really, I've got a guy who's an electrical engineer that wants to come on a trip with me. And I'm really excited to see what happens when you pair him with other artists and I abduct you and take you somewhere for 2 or 3 days. Because part of the thing that's really been nice about that is not only the art that's produced, but that time together and some of the projects that have emerged. And so, you know, having dancers work with visual artists would be really interesting to me. So.
And I'll mention, just as one of the programs that Cultural Development Corporation does, we do a 3-week performing arts festival called the Source Festival that takes place in this space. And one of the weeks is dedicated to artistic blind dates. And what we do is we pair artists from all different disciplines. So, for example, I'll pick on Matthew Mann, who's in the audience. He's a painter. He'll be paired with, I think, a dancer and a theater artist. Is that right? To basically have 6 months to work on a piece and then present a piece in this space. So, other questions? Yeah.
You're all invited. Come to my website. I'll give you a card afterwards. It's campercontemporary.com. And what I try to do is I don't have a strict schedule, but as soon as I have the funds and the place to go, I sort of gather people and match people who I think would be interesting to have a conversation with. And so the last group that I actually took to Miami, we went to Centralia, Pennsylvania for 4 days. And the group didn't know where they were going. They just came with me. I gave them a time limit. And so they came on this trip and spent this time with people. Most of them didn't know each other. But after 4 days of being in a hotel room together and walking around an abandoned coal mining town, ideas get really interesting in that cross-reference. Another group, we built rubber boats and floated around the Baltimore Harbor. And, you know, working together and building something, I think, is a wonderful, wonderful way to get to know people. And then I encourage people to make work, whatever kind they want, about the experience. You have a month to do that afterwards. But the new direction is I'm opening the idea up to other people. So I don't know if you're an artist or if you... It doesn't really matter what you're up to. I'm just excited about the idea of, instead of experiencing it secondhand through coming to the gallery show and seeing how these artists, the good time they had, let's all have a good time. You know, I think art should be fun and engaging for that audience. And so I invite you all to come to campercontemporary.com and shoot me an email and tell me a little bit about yourself.
Okay, so Sheldon's question is about, fostering emerging collectors and bringing them into the fold to help support these projects.
One future topic for panel discussion is collecting emerging art, and emerging art really offers a really great entry point for people who aren't used to collecting, who may be interested in art but haven't started collecting yet, may not be sure exactly which direction they want to go. Because it's fairly low impact, it gives people an opportunity to sort of feel their way through, have some fun, and start making some decisions about what kind of art they want to live with or what kind of art interests them. That's one of the things that's come out of the Academy exhibition. We've noticed year after year, it's not only that emerging artists are interested in the show, but also emerging collectors, because they see this as an opportunity where they can sort of get a foothold in a non-threatening way. And we hope to encourage that same sort of exploration in the Emerge Art Fair. We'll have an educational program with panel discussions and artist talks that will be also involving collectors during the fair.
Just add one thing. Is one interesting byproduct of the technological revolution is the ability to raise money online. There's a fabulous thing called Kickstarter, which probably everybody already knows about. But, you know, that's where artists directly post their projects and raise funds that way. And it could be not even something where there's necessarily much of an object at the end. They might get some kind of premium for their gift. But I think that's a really great way of getting out.
Yeah. I'll mention two things. I think one, that Philippa and the Pink Line Project have done a lot to foster emerging art collectors and sort of take the mystery and take the intimidation out of the process of buying art. I mean, she's hosted numerous sort of panels around that and trying to break down those barriers. And then, you know, I think the other question is, you know, there's not always something to buy. So that's where things like Kickstarter come in. And also a new thing that's in DC, which is KOI, Kitchen of Innovation, where basically everybody pitches in $20 and then votes on projects that are then awarded funds. So I think funds can come from a variety of sources, whether, you know, an emerging collector buying a piece of art or through sort of do-it-yourself fundraising processes. So I don't know, Jose, if you have sort of more to say on that front.
To expand on the emerging. Yeah, I mean, I think it has the same importance, I think, I mean, to get, I mean, I guess one idea is to get art as accessible as possible, and I mean, I primarily focus on more community-based things, but the emerging collector is, I mean, you want people to support your work, you know, you want people to show it to other people, so there is, I think, like some of the problems you guys mentioned, they are really welcoming to that, you know, and I think a lot of times artists will forget, you know, how far their work can go, you know, all it takes is for one person to see it. Even if it's what they would consider a collector or not, an emerging collector or a serious collector, you know, we try to define them in certain ways, but all it takes is someone that really likes it and is exhibiting it, you know, in a more intimate setting. And I think that's, I think that's where one of the best things that comes out of a commercial gallery, actually.
Any other questions? So the question is about the relationship that any of us here have with schools and just how that connection is so important when working with emerging artists.
I started teaching at the Corcoran 2 years ago, and I teach a professional practices class for emerging artists. And I also have started teaching a class on curating theory and practice-based. So my class now is mostly art historians, but some of them are artists. But, yeah, I mean, there's a rich reward in talking with students and working with students and sharing ideas with students. We have a project right now for Billy Friebel's show that's going to be in June at the gallery where my class is actually coming up with exhibition design concepts and helping to write the essay and helping to write the press release. And they're doing the work for me, which is great. But but they're having a really good time. They've never done it before. And they're already proposing these amazing installation ideas. And there's the most rewarding back and forth of learning by working with young emerging artists and emerging curators.
I mean, I'm not sure if it's the same here, but New York, at least, all the MFA programs have open studios, I think, at least twice a semester. So it's actually a lot of people that want to find out about what's going on or what young artists are doing. That's sort of the best place to go, you know. I mean, and there's a good chance a lot of those artists you will see a year or two later at an art fair or a gallery. And it's actually an intimate way. Not that intimate, but it's you can actually you can see them in their raw space, you know, and it's they're there, you know, and you see the work without any frills, you know. And I think that's really important. And a lot of, you know, students, at least in the sort of the master's level, they're really engaged. I mean, they're waiting. They want to participate really, you know, really bad. And I think. There should be, I mean, there's maybe certain disagreements within academics. You know, I taught for a couple of years at Sarah Lawrence College, and certain professors don't want you to learn what's going on in the art world. They kind of want you to kind of suffer on your own, you know, after. So they won't tell you the information, you know. But in the past couple of years, I think at least five or maybe 10, schools, you know, are getting smart enough where they have to invest in the artists as far as promotional training or development, you know, how to write a statement, you know, how to write a grant, just so when they go out there, I mean, they realize it makes the school look bad too. You know, if they're out there and, you know, have school loans and, you know, are kind of living in their parents' house or something. You know, so there's, I think, the students today, at least in MFA, they're all, it's not even the typical age range that you might expect. There's people in late 30s, 40s, 50s. So it's just a more of a need to get, you know, more connected to whether it's art history, theory, elements of their practice that they haven't had a chance to explore, other mediums. And I think that's, to answer your question, the school is like central, I think, to what's happening.
And I think the other question that sort of comes out of that is how schools are fostering or not fostering the type of work that we're talking about today, and whether just sort of traditional modes of art making are being promoted.
For Provision's part, we have a very active internship program, and it actually draws people from all across the academic disciplines, along with art and art history. But you get sociology, you know, international relations, and everything, and mixing those people together and sort of sensitizing them, both the different groups, to all the different issues involved in making art for the future. That's been really rewarding for me. It really, and I think it's a different kind of learning model in a way. We have people in the room from all these different disciplines, and then somebody's talking about something, and we get into a long discussion, what we call the postdoctoral seminar. Pops up every once in a while. So anybody that is interested in interning should be in touch.
So I think we have room for one final question, if anyone has one. So Mariah is asking, based on our experience in other cities, what are we lacking in D.C., and what are new ways of working that can sort of be inserted into what's happening now?
Oh, well, I'll just say quickly. I mean, we're in D.C. You know, we kind of want to be in denial about that a lot of the time. But in fact, it's a really interesting text as a city and a subtext. And there's so much sort of embedded in the power image of the city, the archives that are here, and all that sort of thing. So I'd like to see more work that really does engage the city and tries to deal with it as large and overbearing as it is.
Well, I've lived in Washington since 1981, and the art scene here has changed radically since then in a very positive way, especially in the past few years, I think. I think the main thing that we're lacking now is the rest of the world coming here to see what we're doing and see the creative energy that exists here and is growing. And I think once that happens, it's going to be a different landscape for contemporary art in Washington, D.C. I'm very optimistic about recent developments and the direction that things are moving here.
So I've lived in D.C. all of my life. I was born here and got involved in the arts in 1996. And I've thought recently that wouldn't it be great if we had an Institute for Contemporary Art where things could artists from D.C. and nationally and internationally could come together and have a dialogue, and it could be cross-disciplinary, and wouldn't that be amazing? I mean, that's the tradition of the Kunsthalles throughout Europe, and that's really where, we see a lot of the breaking down of the silos that exist in the art world has started happening in the 60s in those Kunsthalles by being multidisciplinary, by opening the doors, and by embracing art as a social practice. And I think that we have an opportunity with the Emerge Art Fair, as well as any other opportunity that anyone can think of doing, by just creating something. And, you know, the way the world is now, I think there are a lot of art fairs and people set and pop down in cities, you know, quickly for a weekend and have a very meaningful experience. And they talk about that for months and months, maybe years. And, you know, we have an opportunity to have a really meaningful experience with a big, you know, international art fair that's never happened before, that has a different edge to it, that we can call our Kunsthalle, our Institute of Contemporary Art, kind of for a weekend, which I think is pretty amazing.
And just a quick follow-up on that, I'm sorry. I've been working on this project, as have many of us, to revive the vacant space underneath DuPont Circle, the DuPont Underground. And that's a project that's sort of in process right now with the city. But you can find out more about it at DupontUnderground.org. But it hopes to be, you know, a sort of Kunsthalle space for international and local mixed together.
I think those are sort of great examples to end on of things that are happening and the changes that are taking place in the city right now. And it's been interesting for me as well to see everything that's changed in the time that I've been participating. So I'm gonna I just want to wrap things up by thanking our panelists and everyone who came out in the rain today. We had a. A really great group of people and a group of people that I would consider thought leaders in our community and in our field. We had a lot of terrain to cover, and I think there's much more that we could talk about. So we'd love to continue having this discussion at Marvin. And I think at 5 o'clock we'll be going over there, and there's a special $5 Stella. So I wanted to also thank Sheldon Scott again and Marvin, and thank you again to the Pink Line Project. So thanks, everyone.